Hey, this is Tyler, and you're listening to The Lenny and Tyler Show, and I thought today I'd just try to record a quick episode after my last conversation with Daniel Garner of OG Rose. I decided to do a little bit of writing, a short essay, based on some of the things that he and I were discussing, and just to try to, you know, make clear some of my thoughts regarding releases and the loss of the ego ideal and the summons of love. And so I thought I'd just record basically sort of reading this essay and then maybe riffing on it a little bit here and there. It's just called Releases, Loss of Ego Ideal, and the Summons of Love. As far as I understand, here at the beginning of the essay, I kind of try to define in my own way what I understand to be the Lacanian ideal ego and the ego ideal. It's my understanding of the ideal ego is that it is who we desire to become. It's like our idealized persona. I think of it as like the curated Instagram image that we put out there for other people to see, that we, you know, kind of over time sculpt and shape and all that. So that's the ideal ego. And then the ego ideal is that for whom we wish to become our ideal ego. So it's the person whose like or view on Instagram matters most to us. So when we post a picture of ourselves, when people hit the like button, it's like you might scroll through and see, well, who has liked it? And there's maybe one person or a couple people whose like matters to you kind of more than others. But it also can be broader than that. And it can be more vague and not merely just one person. In some sense, the ego ideal of today is actually kind of like the algorithm itself. It's the one for whom we're, posturing for, the one for whom we're sort of dancing and flagellating ourselves to try to win the affection, the recognition, the approval, the praise. So in some sense, the algorithm itself can be in the position structurally of the ego ideal, which is a very interesting thing to think about. That's actually a really sad diagnosis, I guess, of maybe the state of affairs these days, that we're all basically dancing and worshiping and trying to appeal to the algorithm, trying to get the most likes, the most views, the most recognition in sort of this way that it in the end is pretty hollow, because the algorithm isn't something that can even really hold you or like give you a warm embrace or can't physically be there in your life in any way. Other forms of the eco ideal, I think that it can be rooted in like what a given society deems important or values or the values of one's family. So what a given society deems important, of course, the algorithm kind of fits into that. And then what one's family deems as valuable. And so for me, growing up, we used to have this saying of, it was the Murphy way. And the Murphy way, in some sense, can, I think, function as an ego ideal. And so you're trying to shape yourself to be someone who fulfills the desire of the Murphy way. Okay, so those are some definitions to maybe keep in mind as I move through this essay. And in the previous conversation, Daniel Garner and I talked about his use of terms like givens and releases. And so maybe you might need to go back and listen to that if you haven't listened to that already, to understand what we mean by givens and releases, as I'll use them here in this essay. But you might be able to pick up their meaning also just by the context here. So when we are released from a givens, I believe this hasn't occurred because of an intrusion from the real, which is a whole other Lacanian thing that I don't have time to go into now. Thing is, and anytime you try to explain this stuff, if you don't. So my understanding of the real is that it's basically that which erupts between sort of our imaginary and symbolic views of reality, and the ways in which the way we map the territory of our lives never corresponds one-to-one with that territory. Even if the map itself is internally coherent, there's always something that's not accounted for. And that something that isn't accounted for always erupts as, and whatever that thing is structurally in Lacanian speak is in the register of the real, if I'm understanding that all correctly. All right, so when we are released from a givens, I believe this has occurred because of an intrusion from the real, and that this intrusion forces us to reconsider the goodness or the validity or the substantiality of our ego ideal or the object cause of our desire. I think that that would be another way of saying it. That's another Lacanian thing. So when we go through a release, we are reconsidering, we are losing faith potentially in the validity, the substantiality of the ego ideal, and losing the, and which is also, I think, another way of talking, the ego ideal in this sense is another way of talking about the object cause of our desire, because the ego ideal is structurally that which is causing us to desire our ideal ego, our ideal persona, who we are trying to craft ourselves into for Instagram, for the view, the like, the recognition, the praise of the ego ideal. Losing the object cause of desire can lead to existential anxiety, nihilism, a sense of being unmoored, and that we don't belong anywhere, and depression. If having an ego ideal, an other in whose goodness you trust and whose goodness and pleasure you seek to invoke, is necessary for human flourishing, then how do we consciously and wisely choose an ego ideal that will not lead us down, or that will not let us down like the last one did? Because that's when you have a sense of a release, and it, like Daniel Garner said in our conversation, a release happens not when it's like an intellectual thing that you're affirming, but it really is kind of this more emotional space that, or emotional happening event that something kind of gets stripped away from you. And I think what I'm arguing here is that what has gotten stripped away from you is your faith in the goodness, basically, of the givens that you inherited. And the sense of that it's potentially all arbitrary, that what you were given was arbitrary, because you kind of realize that, hey, if I would have was born into a different family or a different country, a different background, the things I value now would have been different. And so how can I be sure that what I was given was is true and right and good, especially when you see inconsistency and contradiction within the people who gave you that worldview, and who they themselves aren't living up to what they're claiming that worldview can give you. So then how do we, when we've been hurt like that, how do we move on? How do we find a new ego ideal? And can we even find one consciously? And I'm going to argue that I don't really think that we can. in the SAS-8. Instead, I think that the kind of ego ideal that eventually can break through after a release has happened is one that sort of breaks through the clearing and the potential place where you could fall into total despair and nihilism. But it's the kind of ego ideal that almost, I would argue, chooses us before we choose it. You know, and as I right now in the moment, the last line of Paul Tillich's book, The Courage to Be, kind of is coming forth. And it's in that last line, he says, the courage to be is rooted in the God who appears when God has disappeared in the anxiety of doubt. So there's almost like this new ego ideal that rises out of the anxiety of doubt that basically fractured your faith in the idea of God that was a givens for you, I would say. All right, so Mari Rudy often emphasizes the idea that as we live life, we will find that we are at times summoned by people, places, events, areas of study, and any number of various activities, and that as we remain faithful to the things that we feel compelled to follow, as we heed the summons emanating from certain objects, we will find a peculiar kind of freedom. It's in a sense a paradoxical freedom, because it's as if we have no say in the matter. Here I stand, I can do no other. Freedom in a psychoanalytic sense is paradoxical, partly because of this distinction between the conscious self and the unconscious, between the conscious wish and the unconscious desire. And Todd McGowan is really good on this. Todd McGowan, back to the essay, Todd McGowan makes a similar point in a talk entitled Capitalist Subjectivity and Unconscious Freedom. He says, the unconscious acts freely prior to the intrusion of consciousness, which is always kind of lagging behind. And so conscious will is never free in the way that the unconscious is. But if we're unconsciously free, this means that freedom is always radically opposed to free will. So whenever anybody says to me, do you believe in free will? I say no, but I believe in freedom. And the most that consciousness can do in the face of our unconscious freedom is to acknowledge its priority and identify the unconscious act as an expression of the subject's desire. So in other words, freedom is conscious only insofar as it cosigns the check that its unconscious already wrote. And in my experience, this feels quite true. Never am I more alive, more guilt-free than when I have remained faithful to the singularity of my desire. I am most myself when I have followed what I know in my heart I have to do, even when such a stance is indefensible to others and even to my conscious self. My conscious rational self. And then this morning I was kind of working on this a little bit from here, because this is where I feel like I keep coming to this question. And this question is something like this. Isn't remaining faithful to one's singular desire just hedonism? And that's a very difficult question, but ultimately I don't think it is. And so I write, let me see if I can argue for why it isn't ultimately hedonism. Throughout Todd McGowan's work, he argues that we achieve unconscious satisfaction through sacrifice. So when we overeat or drink excessively or even work out excessively to the point of injury, we are in those moments sacrificing our future health. And there's an undeniable satisfaction in creating problems for ourselves. Life is always at least psychically more interesting, though usually it's more painful, when it's imploding. So things like racking up debt, procrastinating what you really shouldn't procrastinate, making oneself more machine than man, hitting the self-destruct button on a relationship by saying the one thing that would cause it to all fall apart. These are all various ways we get unconscious satisfaction. And what's common to all these scenarios is that we in some way are sacrificing what would be our own good. In the same way, at least our own good from like a rational standpoint. So that basically when we do these sort of self-destructive acts, we have no recourse to rationality to explain away why we've done these things. Of course, we will try, but at best, all we can do is say, I got nothing. Like, why did I do that? I don't know. it's what I felt I had to do. For McGowan, that's an expression of our freedom. Which is a totally different idea than what we typically think of as freedom. Typically, we think of freedom as the ability to choose between, to make our own choices in life. But really what that comes down to is like, will I choose between Colgate or Crest? Or will I marry this person or this person? We make a list and write out the pros and cons of each person. It's like, no. That's not, in some sense, that's like the opposite of freedom for these thinkers. Freedom is something akin to like when you fall in love with someone and it's kind of a disaster. And it's just like, the only thing I can do is just go along with this thing that has happened to me. And if I betray that, then I betray that which makes me fully human. So in that sense, freedom is paradoxical because it feels as though you have no choice in it. And yet when you affirm it, you feel most free. You feel most alive and most like yourself. And so, yeah, so in the same way, remaining faithful to the summons of love sacrifices one's own good. Often the summons of love calls us to act a fool or destroy our symbolic identities. As Zizek says, love is a catastrophe. So it's not hedonistic because it sacrifices one's own good. So that would be my argument for why remaining faithful to the singularity of your desire is ultimately not hedonistic, is that it actually wrenches you out of your, it has the potential anyways to wrench you out of your symbolic imaginary identity. It has the ability to cause you to blow up your Instagram image or whatever that is. Okay, so what have we learned? I'd argue that a release occurs when an ego ideal is revealed as insubstantial. But without an ego ideal, we are prone to nihilism and depression. Painful though these moments are, confrontation with this negativity is the necessary condition to experience something like a summons in which a new sort of ego ideal begins to emerge. And with that, I have to end this now and try to go to the gym and get some of that fitness going again that I've had absolutely no intrinsic motivation for a while, but we're gonna see if we can get it going. It'll make having a beer and destroying whatever gains I have all the more enjoyable later down the road, anyways, at the very least. So anyways, thanks for listening. Hope you're doing well. We'll talk to you later. Thanks.